Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Every week, today's guest, economist Richard Wolff, hosts the popular show Economic Update. The show takes complex economic issues and makes them understandable, empowering listeners with information to analyze not only their own financial situation, but the economy at large. Economic Update began on a Pacifica station back in March 2011. Today, it is on 120 radio stations nationwide, and it's available for video streaming online. Richard Wolff's latest show is called The System Implodes, Amazon Evictions, Tax Abuses, and a Minimum Wage. And he often shares statistics like this one. Since 1975, capitalism in the United States has redistributed many trillions of dollars from the bottom 90% to the top 10%. And he writes about this in his latest book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Professor Richard Wolff says we cannot go back to normal. We have to transition toward a new economic system that works for everyone. And here is a clip from an animated video about his new book.
The COVID-19 pandemic did more than trigger the third capitalist crash in this new century. The combined pandemic plus crash tore away the veneer that had helped people avoid seeing deep social problems and that had allowed politicians repeatedly to evade solutions. Systemic racism, a badly broken education system, a cash-corrupted politics, ecological degradation. Symptoms of a larger sickness become clearer and more acute every day. My new book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, is a compilation of essays that aims to explain how and why the sickness underlying all these symptoms is the economic system, capitalism.
Richard Wolff is professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst and visiting professor at the New School. Professor Wolff is founder of Democracy at Work, a nonprofit that analyzes capitalism critically as a systemic problem and advocates for democratizing workplaces as part of a solution. He hosts the weekly podcast Economic Update and is the author of many books, including Understanding Socialism and Understanding Marxism. His latest book is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Hi, Professor Wolff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I'm a huge fan of your show. I listen every week. And what I love about it is that in addition to looking at the news of the day, you also bring us statistics that we might not see in the media. And I want to bring up one that you brought up on your show this week. And that is that families with children make up 70% of the people in shelters in the state of New York. You also say that there's a survey out in 2016 showing that 85% of the children living in those shelters did not achieve proficiency scores in math and reading. Professor Wolff, can you talk about why you decided to include that in your latest show?
Yes, it's a little bit of a reaction to being a professional economist, which I have been all my life, that there's a tendency built into our profession to focus a little bit excessively on facts and figures and tables and graphs, and to somehow lose the connection with the realities of daily life that most people are living and are mostly focused on. And so I like periodically to stop and take a step back and show that the things we're discussing in terms of the economy have a very concrete, real daily impact on the lives of millions of people. And so my eye was caught, I was really struck to learn that so many families are now occupying shelters because in our broken system, we do not pay people enough to afford the housing. Or if you like to say it the other way, the housing is too expensive for what we pay people. And as a result, we have large numbers of families who cannot find a reasonable home, who crowd together in a shelter. Shelters are a very mixed bag. Some of them are very nicely organized. Others of them are terrifying. And that's why homeless people often refuse to go there, even when they're urged to do so. And it's a very bad environment for raising children for hundreds of reasons. And it shows up in the fact that the children that are suffering homelessness then, as a result, also suffer in school. They can't keep up. They are moving from one shelter to another. So they're out of one school and to another. And they end up with these proficiency problems. And what that tells you is that they're being raised in such a way that literally they're being prepared for the next generation of homeless people. It's a tragic failure of the system because it's been around for a while, and yet we're allowing it to get worse.
And as you point out, this is happening in a state with so much wealth. And in this segment, you say that if things don't change, in 4 years, we could get someone worse than Trump. You say that we might see even more anger than we've seen over the last 4 years.
I think we will. I think that the very week that just passed with the CPAC meeting, if listeners were able to catch a bit of that, you can feel it. You can sense it in the tone. Going back to normal, which is a phrase that one hears from folks in the Biden administration, going back to normal is going back to the road we were on that brought us Donald Trump and all that happened in the last 4 years. And to go back to that strikes me as literally crazy. I mean, that's what we cannot afford to do. But my fear is, and as I look at the economy, that fear is playing out in front of me, that the inequality, you yourself at the beginning of the program mentioned that the pandemic, which has thrown 20 million people onto unemployment compensation, increased our poverty rolls, worsened our homelessness, and I could go on. During that same time, the richest people in the United States became, as a group, markedly richer. That's dysfunctional economics. That's not the way you want a society or an economy to work. And if the inequality we had before the pandemic was bad and contributed in part to the pandemic, allowing it to get worse during the pandemic means that the upset, the anger, the bitterness at an economic system that is failing so many of our people is going to fester. And I am very concerned that it will take the form of listening to people who have a scapegoat to offer, whether it's immigrants, whether it's the Chinese, whether it's foreigners of one kind or another. This is a very old pattern. A system in trouble tries to survive by blaming outsiders. And that's what we've just seen for 4 years. And I'm very worried that we are not taking the kinds of steps, the kinds of changes that are needed to reverse the direction of this country for the last 25 years.
So, Professor Wolf, let's talk about the problems that we are dealing with, the crises that we're dealing with in the economy. And then let's also talk about solutions. So one stat that I think deserves so much more attention, especially as we're talking about pandemic relief and how much people should be given. A study that came out of Brookings late last year found that half of U.S. workers between 18 to 64 are employed in low-wage jobs. The median annual wage is $18,000. These are not teenagers or young adults just starting their careers, according to this study. So almost half, 44% to be specific, are making $18,000 a year.
Yes, and you know, you don't need a special PhD in economics to know that to live in the United States in the year 2021 on $18,000 a year, even if you are a single individual, means that most of the things we're proudest of in this country are inaccessible to you, unaffordable to you. You know, good colleges in this country are charging tens of thousands of dollars per year to go there. How is a person earning $18,000 total a year needing that money to pay for rent and room, board, clothing, minimum transportation? They can't afford such a college education. They couldn't possibly. You're therefore condemning them and their children to staying in this low-wage half of the American population. That's not a successful economic story. I mean, I live in Manhattan, New York City. Across the street, literally from where I am speaking to you now, is a Food Line. A local church offers food, and the line goes all the way around the block. An old friend of mine came by, very old man. He's in his early 90s. And he looked at me and as he came into the door, and he said, "I remember in the Great Depression, growing up as a child, seeing these kinds of lines. And this is the first time I see them again." That was beautiful for me as a poet, a poetic kind of grasping of what it means to have an economy that has 600 plus billionaires who became almost $1 trillion richer over the last year, at the same time that Brookings is releasing that kind of a study that half the people in the country are earning what are, in fact, poverty wages. That's not a successful system. That's a system that is either going to blow itself up by the sheer contrast between rich and poor, between an ever-shrinking number of very rich and an ever-growing number of poor and near-poor people, or it's going to be a system that is less and less livable, even for the rich among them, because they too are going to be affected by what happens in a society that is so unsuccessful for the mass of its people.
And this is directly related to the fight for 15. Senator Bernie Sanders says that he's going to force politicians to vote on an amendment to restore the $15 minimum wage that the Senate parliamentarian ruled was not allowed in the bill under the rules of budget reconciliation. And people like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they have petitions out basically saying you need to override this. We have to vote on a $15 minimum wage.
Yes, it is. It is so symbolic. I mean, it's a very real thing to raise wages, the federal minimum wage. Let me remind everyone, the federal minimum wage in this country right now, $7.25 per hour, has been that way for many, many years. During the last 11, 12 years that it's been fixed at that level, every year prices rose. Maybe as little as 1 or 2%, some years 2, 3, 4%, which means that every year that you kept the minimum wage what it was, it could buy fewer and fewer things because the prices of things were going up, which means in real terms, the minimum wage has declined in each of the last 10 years. It's unthinkable in a society with people as poor and as limited in their income as we have, as that statistic from Brookings that you mentioned shows, that we condemned our minimum wage workers to a declining affordability for what that minimum wage can buy. I mean, it's extraordinary. So to finally say, gee, let's raise it, forces me to remind everyone listening that $7.25 an hour means that the United States has one of the lowest minimum wages in the world. This is a country that wants to pride itself on being rich, on being successful, on being advanced, on being fill in the blank. Well, maybe in some areas we are, but for the mass of people at the bottom, this is very shabby boasting, because for them, that's not the story. And $15 doesn't begin to deal with this problem. There are already states in the United States that pay more than 15 min, uh, $15 an hour as their minimum wage. There are many countries around the world that already pay that. We are barely catching up, if we do it, to what has been done in other societies that don't have the resources. There is no escape, in my judgment, from realizing that capitalism in the United States has worked very well for the last 40 years for those at the top, and very poorly for virtually everybody else.
Hmm. And even though that's the case, studies show that a boost would increase pay for 27 million workers. So that means 27 million people are making less than that and lift nearly 1 million people out of poverty. We also need to mention benefits, Professor Wolf, because this just doesn't get that much attention, although it definitely did under Prop 22 in California, which I'd love to talk to you about. According to the group Zenefits, the United States is ranked last among other developed nations for benefits like healthcare, paid leave, vacation days, unemployment, and retirement.
Yes, so it's almost painful for me to have to rattle these kinds of data off, but it's very important to understand. The United States is the only country, an advanced industrial country in the world, that does not have a law mandating maternal or paternal leave, that if you have a baby or if you have a health emergency in your family, you are given a certain number of weeks or months off, paid by your employer, that's part of what a civilized society does. We are the only country whose business community, whose conservative community has refused and resisted to do that. Likewise, we are the only advanced industrial country that does not have a comprehensive national health insurance program that means you are covered for illness or injury from the day you are born to the day you die by an insurance that means you can access medical care like every other person in your community or in your society. I was a professor, a visiting professor in Paris, France, a few years ago. And when you have such a position, you get a little medical card. And I got one as a visiting professor. And while I was there, I got what I thought was strep throat. And I did what I would have done in the United States. I went to a neighborhood clinic in Paris. I explained what my illness, what I thought I was having. And they asked me immediately when I came in, please sit down. 2 minutes later, a doctor, not a secretary, not a nurse, not a doctor came out, pressed a button on a computer screen. There came my entire medical history, which they had. He looked it over, made some decisions, gave me a slip of paper, and told me to go two doors down where there would be a lab that would take a swab and a test to see if I had strep throat. I said to him, "Who do I pay?" Mm-hmm. He smiled and said, "Do you have your medical card?" "Yes," I said. "Show it to me." Yeah. Then he said, "This card means you don't pay. We don't, you see, there are no secretaries here. There are no clerks here. We don't file anything. I enter your name in the computer. I describe what I did. That's the end of it. It's part of your record. But I get an annual salary. I'm very happy with it. I'm glad to be able to help the people who come here." And when I went down to the lab, I got exactly the same sort of treatment. Quick, easy, minimum number of people being paid a salary that has to be then, of course, compensated because it's all automated. This is the French system. You don't pay for the medical care you need. You don't hesitate to go. You don't wait until your disease is further advanced, which every doctor tells you don't do. And you can afford not to do that because you're covered. These are benefits that are basic to the quality of life, and there is no excuse for an advanced society not doing it. Not only do we not have these kinds of things in our country, but we're rapidly changing our workforce here in the United States. From paid employees who get at least some benefits that have been accumulated over the years, and we're switching them to what we call gig employees or contract employees, people you pay for a particular task that they perform, but they're not your quote unquote regular employees. And why is that happening? Because then the laws don't apply if they're not your employee, if you're just contracting with them, and then you don't have to give them medical benefits or any of the other things that union contracts or rules in areas would have applied to. In other words, we're going in the wrong direction. And that's what's fueling much of the divisiveness and anger and bitterness in our culture. And I think people should be aware of that as a foundational cause of many of the other things that bother us.
Richard Wolff is professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst and visiting professor at the New School. He's founder of Democracy at Work. He hosts the weekly show Economic Update. His latest book is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. That leads us, Professor Wolff, to talk about Proposition 22 here in California. As you know, last year, companies like Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and Instacart spent more than $200 million to promote this proposition. It treats workers as independent contractors rather than employees with basic protections. It passed by about 59% of the vote in California. It went into effect on January 1st, and we've already seen the fallout. In January, Albertsons and their subsidiary stores laid off unionized delivery drivers to replace them with gig workers with no protections. Labor groups say this is just the beginning of what's to come. So what are your thoughts on this, Professor Wolff? What can we do to ensure workers are protected, given that this passed and CEOs of these companies want copycat bills across the country?
Well, one way to answer your question is to give you a little bit of a history lesson about something that may have passed by folks' awareness. A couple of weeks ago, this issue reached the Supreme Court in the United Kingdom, in England, and the Supreme Court issued its definitive decision. And that decision was that gig workers, contract workers, must be given, do 100% qualify for all the labor protections that have been won by long struggles over the last 200 to 300 years in capitalism in England. In other words, what was achieved by Uber, Lyft, and the others that you mentioned in California was definitively defeated by the Supreme Court in Great Britain. Many of the exact same arguments were brought forward. But because in Britain there is a labor movement significantly stronger than what we have in the United States today, and there is a larger public that is politically supportive of the labor movement than what we have now, although we used to have it more in this country, my view is that this is something that has to be fought again, that has to be brought back to the United States Supreme Court and to the United States Congress as a matter of fundamental social justice and decency. I mean, here is the reality. Human beings in this country, against enormous odds, fought for a very long time to get the right to join a union, to get the right to strike, to get the right to do the various things necessary for American workers to get a decent wage. And we know that it was limited in how far it went because of the very condition of wages in this country, including the wages at the bottom necessitating a minimum wage, as we were just discussing. So it's not as though what the workers won gave them some opportunity to go off the chart in terms of workers' benefits. American workers are not the best paid in the world. They're not even close. So we have these protections. And the movement to gig workers, whether it's done by Lyft and an Uber or Dash or any of the others, these are just maneuvers to get around paying for the cost of the benefits and the protections that workers have won. There is no mystery here. No one should be fooled. There's nothing special or unique about the technology that's being used here. No one should get fascinated with what the internet can do. It is doing all these things in a whole host of places. There is no need and no justification for using technological advance to undo the protections of the working class. But that's exactly what Lyft and Uber and the others have done. They make their profits by not covering workers for the protections that they have won, often by voting, often by real sacrifice. It's a tragedy. And my only argument or my only offer as to how to deal with it is to make people understand what's at stake. Workers who are underpaid, who don't have a benefit, who can't go to a doctor, who haven't got a couple of vacation days to take off, who can't look for or hope to get maternal leave to raise their children, those are people who are going to be bitter and unhappy and miserable and injured and ill. And do you really want to live in a society that works this way? You can have your food delivered to you by a delivery person without requiring that that person live a life you would not accept for yourself. And I think if people get it and understand it, they will rally to get a decision in this country that is the equivalent of what the Supreme Court of Great Britain delivered 2 weeks ago.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at UMass Amherst. He is host of the weekly popular show Economic Update. His latest book is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll get an update on California's vaccine rollout. Blue Shield just took over the state's vaccine program. And if you'd like to sign up on their central site, it is myturn.ca.gov. There is now a phone number you can call, 833-422-4255, 833-422-4255, and we will bring you important updates tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are speaking with Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at UMass Amherst. He is host of the popular show Economic Update, author of many books, including The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. If you'd like to talk about solutions, the changes you'd like to see, where we are with the economy today, you can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Wolff, I have one more question to ask you about Prop 22. This legislation was written by Democrats, not Republicans. And this is a really important point to talk about. Yesterday, the American Prospect reported that Seth Harris will become deputy assistant to President Biden for labor and the economy. Seth Harris is a former labor official under the Obama administration who co-authored an early blueprint of what Uber and Lyft would adopt in California's Prop 22. So it's important to talk about this because it's not like this is a Republican plan. This is a Democratic plan in a state like California, a Democratic state.
Yes, it's tragic in my judgment that the Democratic Party.
I should say that a lot of Dems actually opposed this, like Biden, Harris, Gavin Newsom, our governor, did not take a stand, but some Dems did oppose Prop 22.
Yes, thank God for that, in my opinion. But let me explain what's going on here. One of the ways you can get through a very bad program is if you can associate it with something that is a good objective, that is something people desire. So, for example, in an economy that pays people very little, that makes it hard to get a decent job, that requires people to take two or three jobs, if you represent the Uber Lyft kind of work as an quote unquote job opportunity for people who are in financial distress, often people of color who suffer discrimination, well, then you could get people to think of what you're proposing as a kind of job creation program rather than a labor destroying program in terms of the protections that the labor movement has won over the years. And that was what was done in many parts of the world, including here in New York City, where I live. There was effort made to get the freedom for these companies to underpay people by suggesting that they were providing job opportunities to people who were often denied them or denied adequate job opportunities. I don't for a minute quarrel with the reality that there are inadequate job opportunities. That indeed is one of the features of the capitalism we live in. But to take the failure of capitalism to provide people with adequate jobs as the excuse to remove protections for other working people strikes me as somewhere between horrible and horrific. And I'm not so interested in that range of possibilities. Here's the reality for me. We need to protect and preserve the benefits that workers have won over a long time to try to offset the disadvantage of being a worker in a capitalist system that rewards capitalists so disproportionately. And at the same time, I agree, we have to do something to provide decent jobs at decent incomes to everybody. But it is outrageous to tell us that we must choose between these two. We don't. If we were to tax the wealthy who have escaped their fair share of taxation, and I'd be glad to give you a dozen examples in the United States and in California over the last 20 or 30 years, if we took even small steps in the direction of taxing the super rich, we would be able to protect the workers who have benefits and to give jobs to the people who need them. But setting them against each other, which is what your referendum in California did, so that those who are desperate for a job become complicit in taking away protections from workers who won them, or vice versa, that is a cruel and cynical political ploy. What it does at the end is leave Uber and Lyft able to generate crazy profits, while masses of workers lose the benefits in just the example of the supermarket that you offered at the beginning of posing the question.
Hmm. Well, we'll talk about taxes in a minute, but we have a number of callers on the line. So let's hear from a few first. Let's go to Ariana in San Francisco. Hi, Ariana. Welcome to the show.
Thank you to you both for your service and your rigor. I really appreciate you both. So compassionate. I have two very big points to make. Bear with me. The first is that at the end of World War II, there was a force, a genocidal criminal force unleashed because the energy of the world war had to go somewhere, and it was the force of commercialization in which everything is being commodified. Every forest, even people, are commodified, where the economy is the religion and money and convenience are gods. And it's in everyone's psyche because people want two for one, not only at Walmart because they can't afford anything, but workers are meant to work two jobs as one person. It's totally been hypnotized and integrated into everyone, every party, and we have to call it by name. It's the forces of commercialization, and it needs to be exposed and condemned. The second thing is about the antidote. The planet is a living being, and like any being, it becomes diseased and in pain and killed off when there's a block of energy. When you have a block, you are going to have pain in your body. So when there is a block in flow in the economy and wealth is hoarded in one sector of society, that means there's going to be a block in the world, north to south, within cities, within ultra-wealthy people and their corporations that defy all laws. And most of these transnational corporations are American-owned, stock-held by Americans, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans. We have to understand that sharing is the key.
Well, Arianna, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to take a couple more calls, and then we will get a response from Professor Wolf. Let's go to Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much. And Professor Wolf wants you to know, longtime fan, really trust your perspective. I was wondering if you could comment on the excellent show that Rose did on March 2nd, how Medicare for All would work and transform health care in the U.S. I think that should be mandatory listening for all citizens in this country, and I will take my answer off the air.
All right, we'll get a comment in just a minute. Thank you so much, Chris. And if anyone missed that show, that was yesterday. Let's go next to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. Professor, I'm another big fan. I had a question, and I guess to use the cliche, is Marxism, qua Marxism, is the name Marx too much of a red flag to sell policies in this country that most people would ordinarily agree with? Like, for example, very few people would think that we have a socialized police department or a socialized fire department. And yet, to the right-wing libertarians like Murray Rothbard, these are socialism. How can we sell these policies and these sensibilities to the American public? And as I said, I just think the name Marx is, as I said, such a red flag that it encumbers the effort too much.
Well, thanks, Phil. We saw how the word socialist was used in the last election, so I'm sure Professor Wolf has some thoughts about that one. We'll take one more call, and then we'll get comments. Let's go to Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede.
Hi,
welcome to the
morning.
Show.
The fact is, let's face the fact, home prices went up by 40, 50, 100 times, not percent, at least 100%. Wages now we're fighting about $15? $250 in the 60s was far more money than you can buy today with even $15. The fact is, the U.S. economy is broken and beyond repair. It all began with Reagan and his puppet master, the New Liberals, who destroyed this country. Jobs were outsourced, factories were closed, and we're paying the price right now. I was at Cal for 13 years. Tuition was free. Healthcare was free. What happened? It is over. It is over for the economy of this country. We have to start all over again. This is very, very, very bad. 1% of Americans have far more wealth than the 99% of Americans. This is shame. 80 million Americans don't have enough money to eat, even before the pandemic. This is unforgivable, unforgivable how dozen people, Milton Friedman, Guinness Mann, Rubin, Geithner, how these few people totally destroyed the economy of this great country.
Well, thank you so much, Ede. If we can start with that comment, Professor Wolf, one of my favorite shows that you've done was about how the capitalist class really crushed the unions, the socialists, and the communists. That movement after the New Deal. I just think it's so important to learn from that history. I mean, obviously, Reagan was a major turning point, but we need to go even further back.
Yeah, let's quickly review the history. I couldn't agree with you more. A revelation and explains a great deal and dovetails beautifully with the last gentleman's question that he put or the comments that he made. People have to remember that the last time capitalism crashed the way it is crashing now was back in the Great Depression. That's why we call it the Great Depression, from 1929 to 1941, a very long time, 12 years basically, that this economy was a collapsed economy. In 1933, unemployment peaked at 25%. One out of four Americans in the labor movement had no job, which means every single family had a mother or a father or a son or a cousin or an uncle or an aunt who didn't have a job, who therefore had to fall back on the resources of the rest of the people at a time when their incomes were being pinched and their job possibilities under attack. It was a terrible, terrible time. But the interesting thing that happened then, which has not yet happened now, was that the American people rose up and demanded change. First, they organized a labor movement. People may not know, but something called the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, mobilized and said to people, you're going to get through this Great Depression better if you're unified in a union than if you try to do it on your own. Millions of Americans, tens of millions of Americans agreed with that argument, joined unions. It was the greatest union drive in American history. Never had anything like it before, and we've never had anything like it since. And to working together with them, and this may surprise some of the listeners, were two socialist parties and a communist party, and they all worked together, the unions, the socialists, and the communists, to mobilize. And boy, did they. And they went to the president of the United States and they said to him, then Franklin Roosevelt, you've got to help the millions of Americans suffering this collapse of capitalism. If you do, we will make you a hero. But if you don't, we're not going to vote for you anymore and you won't be president much longer. Roosevelt was a smart politician. He understood they were not bluffing. They knew what they were doing. So he went back and he said to the business community, because he was a Roosevelt, he came from that community, you've got to give me the money because we're having a depression. The government doesn't have the money. You have the money, you, the wealthy, and you're going to have to give it to me so I can take care of the mass of people. But I urge you to do it, because if you don't, this country's going to blow up and you may end up with no money at all. That they split. Half of them went with him. They bought the argument. The other half never did. The half that never did, that's CPAC. That's the people who are the conservatives in America today. But he had enough support. So here's what he did. First, he created Social Security. For the first time in American history, if you were 65 years of age or older, you got a check every month for the rest of your life at a time when the government had no money. The second thing was the unemployment compensation. We had never had that in America before either. If you lose your job, the government will give you a check every week for a year to help you through. Number three, a public jobs program. 15 million people who built some of the most beautiful monuments there in San Francisco, by the way, as you all know, because they got that government job, which gave them an income so they could hold on to their apartment or hold on to their home. It revolutionized the country. And you know who paid for all of that since the government had no money? Business and the rich. Mr. Roosevelt taxed corporations and the rich big time to pay for helping the mass of people. Something which we hear from our politicians today isn't possible, not only was possible, but it was done. And here's the news you may want to think about. Mr. Roosevelt, who did it under the pressure from the unions and socialists and the communists, was reelected three times. He was the most popular president in the history of the United States for doing what current politicians, unfortunately Democrats as well as Republicans, seem to think is an undoable thing. Well, it isn't undoable. We've done it before, and it was the royal road to a level of political mastery and political success that would put the current folks to shame. So I agree with the last gentleman. We have been going downhill because after World War II, with this successful uprising, if you like, a peaceful uprising of the mass of people, the conservatives, the business community pushed back and they destroyed the so-called New Deal coalition. They went after the communists and demonized them. Then they went after the socialists and demonized them. And for the last 40 years, they've been shrinking the labor movement step by step. Republicans taking the lead, Democrats often allowing the process to go. So we don't have a powerful coalition today to stop all of these things, to make the progress achieved in the 30s and 40s continue rather than to be undone, as has been happened. So the gentleman is right. It's been a deterioration, but there's no mystery about it. And you don't have to look at any particular politician, Reagan, Trump, or anybody else, because it was a larger social process, which we can reverse, but we have to understand it if we're going to reverse it. And now let me quickly respond to the others. I won't walk away from the label Marx, and I'll tell you why. It's very honest. It's very personal. When I went to the university, and I went to all the fancy ones in this country, I went to Harvard as an undergraduate. I went to Stanford near you for my master's degree in economics, and I finished my education at Yale. So I'm a poster boy for elite education. In the 20 semesters that I went to school in those three institutions, only once did any professor talk seriously about what Marx had to offer us. And I learned then that Marx has a lot to offer us. You can learn something. I went, I read Marx, and I learned something. And I'm not going to renounce it. I'm not going to deny it. I'm not going to pander to people who didn't do that kind of work and never got the benefit of what they learned. I did learn. Do I use only Marxism in my work? Of course not. Is Marx right on everything? Of course not. Nobody is. He isn't either. But you can learn something from a critic, just like you can learn something from a person who celebrates a system. Most of the people I was asked to read as a student celebrated capitalism, and I have no objection to reading that. But I wanted to hear the point of view of a critic. Marx was and is the foremost critic, and I learned a lot. And I don't think the American people, if they're talked to in an honest way about that, will be any different from me. I was born in the middle of the United States in a place called Youngstown, Ohio. I'm as American as the next person. I find it interesting and illuminating. And for those of you who've been kind enough to say that you've learned something from the programs we do, well, little old Karl Marx gets some of the credit for that too. Mm-hmm. And as to the notion of a commercialism, the opening question, absolutely. We live in a system that has pandered to capitalism, has pandered to the people who sit at the top. And the way they make their money is by producing commodities and getting us to buy them. You know about advertising. We're surrounded all day, every day by endless efforts on TV, on the radio, on the billboard that we pass, telling us buy this, get this, do that, don't do the other thing. Everything is driven to make money for those who sit in a position to sell us. Does it affect our psyche? Does it affect our psychology? Does it affect our relationships with one another? Yes, it does. And not in ways that we want or need or have any sense in keeping. We keep those things because it's profitable to the people who make them happen, not because we get some benefit. Many of us turn off the advertising when it comes on to the podcast or the TV program or the radio, and we don't look at it because we don't want it. And the enormous wealth used in producing the advertising we don't want is an enormous waste. Those resources could be there to give us the health care that other societies have, to do something about the schools who need much, much more in the way of help than we give them. We could have a better society if we mobilize to do it. That's why I make the programs I do, and that's my response to the very interesting comments that folks have called in.
What are your thoughts, Professor Wolf, about building these movements? You talked about Amazon in your last episode, and we know that the union busting is really intense there right now in Alabama. So there's that happening. There's union efforts happening in other parts of the country. There's rallies going on. You know, workers who are making the lowest wages with no benefits are taking to the streets. Given what you know about the socialists, the communists, that movement under Roosevelt, what will it take to build back a larger, stronger movement that cannot be crushed?
Well, you know, here's my answer. I live in a part of Manhattan that's called Union Square. It's a very nice part, Lower Manhattan. Some of you listening may know about this area. And once I did a little bit of historical work about the 1930s. During the 1930s, Union Square, partly because of that name, Union Square, was a place that showed demonstrations by working people almost every day during some of the years during the 1930s. Workers made it clear in the streets loudly, in a peaceful way, but clearly and loudly, that they were not willing to accept massive unemployment, massive poverty, coexisting with obscene amounts of wealth. And that is an important part of politics. I take my hat off. I respect the people who have enough commitment to get out there, to make it known to their fellow citizens how strongly they feel, what they're going through, what kinds of changes they want. I think they are allies of people like me that are trying to come up with concrete ways to achieve an improvement. And here's the one that I focus on most. I think the core problem in a capitalist system is the way we've organized our enterprises. We allow our factories, our stores, and our offices to be organized in a fundamentally undemocratic way. A tiny group of people at the top, the owner of the business, the family that owns the business, or if it's a corporation, the board of directors that are elected by the major shareholders. Tiny minorities in every business. These folks at the top make all the decisions. What gets produced, what technology is used, where the production occurs, and what is done with whatever profits the enterprise generates. All the rest, the vast majority, the employees have to do and live and accept with the decisions made by that tiny group over whom the employees exercise no control. Where we live, we vote on the mayor or the city council person or the governor. We have some say. Once we go to work, we have no say. I think that's the root problem. I think we would get different policies in our businesses, different programs of hiring people, different ways of solving our social problems if we put the people in charge, if we converted the organization of our business from top-down, undemocratic capitalist system to a worker cooperative system based on one person, one vote in each enterprise to make the decisions of that enterprise. For example, would the people democratically decide to give a few folks in the business billions or millions of dollars while everybody else can't send their kid to college? I don't think so. If that were a democratic decision, you might pay some people more than others, but you would have the majority make sure that the basic community's needs are addressed. That's what's missing in our society. I don't think a rule, a law, or this or that election alone is sufficient. I think we need to learn that because of what's going on in our capitalism, we need to go and do something different.
To the Professor Wolf, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I would love to have you back soon to talk more about worker-owned co-ops. There was a good piece in the New York Times about Mondragon, the co-ops in Spain. And under COVID, they didn't lose their jobs and they got most of their salary because they are co-ops. So we'd love to have you back to talk about that.
Be my pleasure. I'd be glad to do it.
Great. Thank you so much. Richard Wolf is professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He is host of the weekly popular show Economic Update. His latest book is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.